There is off-the-field controversy. Homophobic and racist tweets were written a few years ago by reliever Josh Hader surfaced this week during the All-Star break. The 24-year-old Hader apologized, saying they did not reflect his values or the person he is now. Brewers GM David Stearns wants Hader to re-earn the trust of his teammates. In the American League, the White Sox are in Seattle. In college league ball, the Kingfish lost to Fond du Lac 6-5. Now the forecast from the National Weather Service. Scattered showers and thunderstorms through tonight. A high around 76, an overnight low around 66. A beach hazards warning is in effect on Lake Michigan until early this afternoon for high waves and dangerous currents. For tomorrow, showers likely with thunderstorms possible during the afternoon. Cloudy, a high of 75. For Sunday, becoming mostly sunny, a high of 77. Right now, we have a temperature reading of 72 degrees. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Gregory Berg is coming up.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we are looking back at two pivotal years, 1968 and 1969, in the groundbreaking work of Jane Goodall in the rural area of Tanzania, studying chimpanzees in the wild. The book at hand is called The Ghosts of Gombe, A True Story of Love and Death in an African Wilderness, written by Dale Peterson, a best-selling author who has written books about computers, anthropology, art, evolution, literature, and psychiatry, and a best-selling biography of Jane Goodall, titled Jane Goodall, The Woman Who Redefined Man. I began my interview with Dale Peterson by asking him about the special challenge of writing books about topics in which he himself does not have extensive academic background or training.
I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about what's the word we should use. How about ignorance in terms of when one is trying to write thoughtfully and about topics about which you do not have extensive training nor extensive experience? I suspect to some extent it can work as an advantage in some ways, particularly if right. you're interested in communicating with a wide general public of, right. of listeners. Yeah. There's obviously lots of pitfalls as well. What have been some of your guiding principles in terms of working within fields about which you were in no way, at least at the outset, an expert?
Well, that's right. You've put your finger on it. In some ways, it's a huge disadvantage. In other ways, it's an advantage because you know the naive questions to ask. And so you have to play to your strengths. It probably means that you will not be writing a wonderful technical book about a subject. You'll be writing a popular book for people like you who don't know much about the subject either. That was my working assumption with the computers. And when I then co-authored a book with Jane Goodall, you know, our co-authored book was about chimpanzees. And so, you know, at first you ask yourself, what am I doing working with the world's great expert on wild chimpanzees? What do I have to contribute? And that was, you know, I had to answer that question. And I did contribute a lot. As first of all, I did a lot of the research for the book, and I did most of the writing, and so Jane actually just sort of contributed her expertise. She wrote some parts, too, but, you know, so she told me when I was wrong, and she was, you know, it's like having the world's best professor, somebody who just is spectacularly informed about a subject. But I also had to, you know, what do I contribute to? And that first book, I was based upon a Shakespearean play. And, you know, as a an English major and PhD in English, I knew something about Shakespeare, and it turns out that the Shakespeare's last completed, fully completed play, The Tempest, which is has a central character who's described as a man-monster, half-man, half-animal, could have been based upon the first reports coming to Europe of chimpanzees and gorillas. And the play also just gives a wonderful presentation of the human reaction to a creature who's not quite human, but who in many ways seems human. And so it's really a wonderful metaphor for the human relationship with chimpanzees. And so I structured the entire book around that play very overtly. And I think it worked very well. The book was a big success, and the most important part of that success was that Jane liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was this, you know, the start of our friendship.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dale Peterson, a prolific and successful author whose latest book is titled The Ghosts of Gombe, A True Story of Love and Death in an African Wilderness. Ahead of us, exploring some of the specific issues and questions explored in your book, this latest book, we should learn a little bit more about Dr. Jane Goodall. And particularly, I think it would be helpful for our listeners for you to sketch a bit about who she was before the events that are chronicled in your book, which occurred in 1968 and 1969. That is some years after she first began doing this this work with chimpanzees in rural Tanzania. Maybe explain whatever you think is helpful for us to know about her earliest life and background, and then it would certainly be good to know what initially brought her to Tanzania in 1960.
Right. Well, I suppose I might start by saying, you know, in the past when I've told people I was writing about Jane Goodall, they said, "Oh, yes, you mean the woman who, wasn't she killed? Didn't she work?" No, that's Diane Fossey. Diane Fossey worked with gorillas, another great ape species, and Jane worked with chimpanzees. And Jane was the pioneer. She was there before Diane, and she really pioneered the entire approach of dealing with a potentially very dangerous wild animal. One of the reasons that Jane was the first to study chimpanzees was that the reigning paradigm was that you couldn't study chimpanzees or gorillas because they were too dangerous. They would attack you and tear you to pieces in a second. And it is true that chimpanzees in zoos and in laboratories, you know, chimpanzees who are caged are very dangerous. And they're dangerous because they're angry about being caged, basically, and they're perverted by that circumstance. In the wild, they can escape, so they have that freedom. They can just turn around and run away if they're scared, so they don't have to attack. Jane guessed that that would be the case, and she guessed that if she went into the forest by herself and acted very non-threatening, you know, never carried a gun, never pressed her luck, never pushed too far, respected the boundaries that the chimpanzee set, she guessed that she would not be hurt, and she guessed that eventually she would come to a point where she could actually study them. And that happened. And, you know, basically she tamed them, and they became less and less afraid of her. She, you know, started this in the summer of 1960. She went there with her mother and built, you know, set up a tent in the middle of this forest that had wild chimpanzees in it. She had an African cook as well, a man named Dominic Bandora. And so the three of them, Jane, her mother, and Dominic, were there by themselves. And Jane was just going out every day. The chimps were terrified of her. They would see her and run or disappear. But eventually, became less terrified, and eventually it just became casually used to her.
Hmm.
That was the early 60s, and it was an amazing breakthrough. I mean, this was, you know, she became world famous very quickly. By 1963, she was receiving letters from fans all over the world, and it was amazing breakthrough research. I don't think we quite recognize today what a spectacular breakthrough it was. The first National Geographic article about her came out in the summer of 1963. And, you know, there was something iconic about this young, very slight-seeming English woman, you know, dressed very lightly, no pith helmet, no shoes even, so it would go barefoot. Certainly no sense of that she was in the middle of this dangerous African rainforest. And so it was not only a breakthrough, but it was a fascinating breakthrough, and it was done by a woman. So she was also, and it was done by a woman because men were too scared to do it.
Hmm.
That was part of the background story.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
I don't remember if it was in this book or someplace else that I read this, but I have heard that Jane Goodall embarked on this exploration beginning in 1960 without the extensive academic background in the discipline that one might have expected her to have, and that it's entirely possible, maybe likely, that is one of the reasons why she sort of forged a new path, because she was not so strictly and thoroughly indoctrinated into the ways in which chimpanzees had been studied before, and was not maybe thoroughly indoctrinated into all of the assumptions that had blithely been made for a long, long time. Can you expand on that?
Well, I think you've put it well, but the one thing you got wrong was that nobody had studied chimpanzees before to any significant degree.
Hmm.
So there was nothing much to be indoctrinated in, but she hadn't even gone to college. She was the secretary of Dr. Louis Leakey, the paleoanthropologist. And Leakey was the one who set her up to go into the forest because he recognized that she had the stamina and the passion to do this. And Leakey also just didn't care about, you know, the traditional academic disciplines. But the discipline of animal watching was in its infancy. So nobody really knew how to study a dangerous wild animal like chimpanzees. So just simply, you know, a few people had tried it but had not succeeded to any degree. And so Jane was really a pioneer, a real breakthrough.
Right. One of the things you write in your prologue is Jane Goodall thought differently and tried a different approach. Instead of hiding, she let herself be seen. She moved through the forest without stealth. She showed herself openly, never acted fearful, and tried never to provoke fear. And we read those words and they make perfect sense, and yet apparently she was a trailblazer in this respect.
She was. She absolutely was.
I want to ask you about another line later in that very same paragraph, which at a glance does not make perfect sense. You write, she was taming them, meaning the chimpanzees, and in the process of doing so, she opened up for the first time in history the hidden world of wild chimpanzees. The thing that does not make perfect sense to me isn't something happening to those wild chimpanzees, and is, in a sense, isn't their behavior changing from what it would otherwise be because she is taming them? Or do you mean taming in a way that is different from the way we sometimes use that term?
Well, That's a good question. You know, the taming part was taming in that particular circumstance. So they were no longer afraid of her, but they were still behaving. There were still wild animals living a wild animal's life. And I think that, you know, all of her discoveries and early work have been confirmed by studies of chimps in several other places in Africa. So it is true that, you know, there was a change in their relationship to this human who appeared in there. But I think it can be argued, and it's very clear to me, that that was the only basic change that happened. They just, essentially, they became bored with her. In the book, I actually used the metaphor, you know, in The Ghosts of Gombe, I used the metaphor of ghosts. Jane was like a ghost to them. It wasn't that they, you know, were happy to see her or came into the camp and greeted her, although they recognized her, but they essentially ignored her. They would come into camp, and she was just this, they didn't care about her. She wasn't part of their social world. She wasn't part of their life. And I think it was true to all of the other researchers to some significant degree, not fully. And eventually there were, you know, the chimps began to recognize the humans as interesting individuals, but the primary way they were interacting for the many years was the chimps would come into camp, the people would be there, they'd be studying them, and the chimps would ignore them, and they'd be reacting to each other, just as, you know, you and I, even when we go to a zoo, we look at the wild animals, but we're reacting with each other. You take your wife to the zoo, your friend, your child, you watch the animals, but you interact with the people. And the opposite of that is the chimps. The chimps knew there were people around in the camp, and they would come in and get bananas because Jane started putting bananas out. But they just ignored the people. Just, you know, people were background.
We're speaking with Dale Peterson about his book, The Ghosts of Gombe, A True Story of Love and Death in an African Wilderness. So we have already talked about Jane Goodall and the work that she began in 1960 in rural Tanzania, and the enormous celebrity which surrounded her within 2 or 3 years of the onset of that work. And she pursued academic study in the field, I think became Dr. Jane Goodall at some point during that decade. So as quite a young woman, and her fame only grew. I'm curious, a lot of times when somebody becomes nearly an overnight celebrity, there is to some extent a misunderstanding of who they are, or maybe gross oversimplifications are drawn about who they are and the work that they are doing. Do you think that occurred to a significant extent with Jane Goodall?
I think she's always, you know, obviously her fame has affected her, and I've spent enough time with her to know that she enjoys the attention, but I don't think it's changed her, and I think there are an awful lot of people who are famous who haven't done anything, you know, to earn their fame. They're either good looking, or they have some small talent somewhere, and or they've married, you know, somebody famous. Jane's not like that. She earned her fame. She's fully justified, and she is an extraordinary person. She was before she was famous. She is afterwards. And so I know her very, very well, and I think the public person is very similar to the private person.
So her work begins in 1960. The events that you specifically focus on in this book, The Ghosts of Gombe, are 1968 to 1969. Trace for us kind of the general arc between when she began this research and where things were in 1968. By that point, was it just the same work just being done more extensively, or I mean, in what way was Jane Goodall trying to explore, in a sense, new vistas by this point in the decade?
Yeah, well, when she began, of course, she was working alone, and she was spent all of her time at Gombe. As I said, she arrived with her mother and Dominic Bandura, the African cook. By the end of the decade, she was really ambitiously trying to expand the operation so it became an international research. She was trying to bring in researchers who would study not only the chimpanzees, but the baboons and a couple of the monkey species at Gombe. I mean, Gombe is biologically a very rich place, so it was a good place to do wild animal studies of many kinds. And that was her ambition was to create this research center. At the same time, she had gotten married, she had a son, and also the further stress was that National Geographic was starting to cut her funding. Meanwhile, her husband was an ambitious man who was a photographer who was doing photography and filmmaking in the Serengeti. So Jane had not only Gombe to think of, but she had to go to her husband's camp in the Serengeti. So she was just very, very busy. And she's always been a woman who can handle a tremendous amount of stress, but the result of it was at this time was she was relying a lot on volunteers to work at Gombe. So she was there sometimes and there not other times. And, you know, the book is focused, of course, on the death of this young researcher. And Jane was not there at the time. It's sad she wasn't, and I know she feels sad about that. But the researcher disappeared 49 years ago to this day, on July 12th, 1969. And Jane was with her husband elsewhere, and the book essentially explores that disappearance. And through exploring that, you know, what happened to her? I mean, her body was found 6 days later, so we know that she met a violent end. Her body was found with the skull cracked open at the base of a high waterfall. So the presumption at the time had been that it was a terrible accident, and that was certainly the police report concluded that. But there were no witnesses, and I began to write this book because I was approached by the man who had been a volunteer at Gombe at that time and later became Jane's colleague, Geisa Teleki, and also became my friend. And in 2006, he decided he wanted to talk about Ruth. So the book the core of the book is based on my conversations with Geisa, which expanded to interviews of everybody else I could get a hold of who had been there at the time, and looking at records and correspondence and so on. What happened to Ruth? That was the question I decided the book would be.
And it's interesting because in exploring that very focused question, you end up talking about all kinds of other things,
right,
for the sake of background. And so this becomes a book that's about much more than just the mystery surrounding her death. Let's talk for a moment about your relationship with Geisa Teleki, again, the man who called you up in fall of 2006 and said he wanted to talk about Ruth. This is someone you had already known and collaborated with. And it's interesting. You say that you never felt that your friendship with him was an easy one. And yet, obviously, the two of you had a very powerful connection with one another. Explain a little more about your relationship before this phone call in 2006. And be sure to say something also about where Mr. Teleki found himself in terms of his own health in the fall of 2006.
Yes, okay. That's a tall order, by the way. But so Geisa Teleki, I I think I mentioned earlier that he was the one who introduced me to Jane in 1989. Coincidentally, that was 20 years after Ruth's death. And Jane had, Geza had been Jane's student at the time of Ruth's death. I think I mentioned that. He became her colleague, and so by 1989, he was Jane's colleague. And Geza introduced me to her. Jane and I co-authored this book. It's called Visions of Caliban, and it's about chimpanzees. And Geza was the researcher on that book. And it was a very difficult book to write for a number of reasons, one of which was that there was, we were writing about some political events and some conspiratorial work having to do with the import and export of chimps out of Africa. And Geza, his role as a researcher was how we began to get to know each other. And I mentioned earlier that Jane and I were friends after that book, and Geza and I were friends too. And so that, you know, the book was really a formative experience for the three of us. So just as, you know, I started a long friendship with Jane, it was the start of a long friendship with Geza. I had known early on that Geza had lost his girlfriend, his fiance, at Gombe, but I hadn't known anything about it, and Geza was very tight-lipped about it. And So he didn't start to tell me these things until 2006, when he essentially, his body was breaking down. And I talk about that in the book. It's complicated, but he was being poisoned. That's the conclusion, was that he was being poisoned from having lived in a part of suburban Washington, D.C. that had been near the site where there was chemical warfare research during World War One, and we believe that that research, which was a massive research operation going on, involved major poisons that were disposed on site and became, you know, within the soil and groundwater, so that. That's why Geza died, and I believe that, and Geza documented that pretty well. And there's been journalism done on this subject as well.
So you end up speaking with him to further explore this question about this person that he had known and with whom he had been very, very close, and you end up talking with a number of others who were involved in this research, including a woman by the name of Carol Gale. What was it like for these people to be looking back over the course of so many years? How difficult was it?
Well, it was very painful, and it was even painful for me. I will say that, you know, this was a generational tale. Ruth was in her mid-20s when she died in 1969. I was in my mid-20s in 1969. Geza was, and Carol was. So we were all part of this same generation that went through, of Americans who went through the same kind of traumatic circumstances or difficult circumstances of the late 60s. So we had that in common. And Ruth's death was kind of haunting for me, and certainly haunting for Geza and Carol, both of whom had been very close to Ruth at Gombe. And in fact, part of the, you know, the title of the book, The Ghosts of Gombe, both Geza and Carol reported having seen Ruth's ghost. They didn't use the word ghost. They would talk about vision, but it was a, for both of them, it was a very powerful experience. And I opened the book with Geza's tale, and it happened in 2006 when Ruth appeared to him one evening, and it was not a dream as far as he was concerned. The best he had come up with was it was a vision. You know, appeared to him with blood on her head, the cracked skull, And he was in bed at the time, and she appeared and tried to get in bed with him. Carol had a vision of Ruth that happened within a few days after her death. And in that case, Carol, you know, when Ruth disappeared on July 12th, everybody was, you know, they were terrified that she had, you know, something had happened to her, of course. And so everybody at Gombe formed search teams trying to find the body or find her if she was still alive. And there was that hope for the first few days of the search. Everybody except Carol, who was in bed with malaria, in a tent, you know, quarantined and trying to recover from this attack of malaria. And then Ruth came to her. Carol describes it. Ruth came to me one night, and, you know, one night that Ruth appeared at the door, slammed the door in this hut she was staying in. It wasn't a tent, it was a hut. Slammed the door and said to Carol, "Why haven't you come to find me?" And Carol was just shocked and terrified to see Ruth standing there, and then, of course, she disappeared. It was not a real Ruth. It was a vision. And that appearance caused Carol to get out of bed the next morning, in spite of the fact that she was still weak from the malaria, and join in the search. And Carol was the one who found the body a few days later.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty remarkable. And, you know, I use the word haunting. We were all haunted by Ruth's death. And I felt, by the time I had finished this book, that I was losing sleep, and I was equally haunted and tormented. And, you know, it was very painful to think about the death of a young person in the prime of her life. It's such a loss.
Right. And, of course, we get the sense of these young adults who are have made their way to Africa, relishing such a sort of real life adventure, and then in a sense to have such a brutal tragedy intrude upon this sense of adventure was of course such a shock. One of the things that is surprising about your book is that it is so much about personalities, interpersonal relationships, and friendships and romances and friction and spats. and it turns out that is an extremely important aspect of doing this kind of research and work under these kind of circumstances. And in particular, the fact that people are so remote in terms of removed from civilization and yet in such close quarters with one another. Talk more about this. Describe what I am talking about, and why this figures so prominently in your book.
Yes, humans are social beings, just as chimpanzees are, and social experience can go bad, and there was always that tension. I think of Gombe, particularly in that late 60s, is so isolated. They didn't get, you know, they've subscribed to Time magazine, but it would come 2 weeks late. They couldn't get any radio stations on the air except, you know, occasionally a scratchy voice from Voice of America that would disappear, or something from BBC that would, you know, that they couldn't keep the signal on. And so they were, there was tremendous isolation, and combined with that isolation was this intimacy. You know, they were forced together. And just imagine if you're with somebody that you don't really like. I think of it as being like space travel, and it's something, you know, it makes me think, if we send people to the moon, how are you going to do that? I mean, human beings have feelings. They like some people, they don't like other people. Sometimes you feel a sexual attraction to someone, sometimes you feel the opposite. Put a group of humans in a small area and force them to be with each other, and you've got a recipe for terrible disaster. And I felt that was part of what was going on. And I wanted to explore that, explore the relationships and how they worked out. And I do in the book, I think it's a, you know, among other things, it's a very interesting aspect of remote field research is just the nature of relationships.
One of the things that is intriguing about the work that they were doing was, first of all, that some of these young researchers actually persuaded Jane Goodall to permit them to follow these chimps, to not just observe them when they would come into the village in search of the bananas that were there,
right. But
that they believed fervently that this research could be taken to kind of another level. Just talk about that.
Right. Well, of course, Jane had done that sort of thing when she first came to Gombe. She was following the chimps, trying to find the chimps. And so the idea that this could be done was exciting to Jane, that other people wanted to do it. She had set up the banana provisioning by the late 1960s as a way to regularize the observation. So they would put out bananas at night, the chimps would come in the morning, eat the bananas, and then, as we discussed earlier, they were ignoring the people, and they were interacting with each other. So you actually got a good sense. You were able to, you know, they identified, they knew the individuals, they knew their relationships, they knew their typical interactions. They were beginning to develop a theory about the nature of chimpanzee society. All of that was true, but the banana provisioning during this period had a problem. And that problem was mainly that baboons, a troop of baboons at Gombe, had discovered the bananas. So when the chimps would come in the morning and show up, there might be a dozen chimps or even more, but there would also be at some point 50 baboons sitting around also wanting to have some bananas. So then there was conflict between the baboons and the chimps. And chimps are, you know, very formidable animals. They're very powerful, very strong, and they're quite big. Even the Gombe chimps, who I think are slightly smaller than a lot of chimpanzees in other parts of Africa, the males will weigh 100 pounds, and this is 100 pounds of solid, rock-solid muscle. Muscle that is superhuman in its strength. And they're formidable animals, and basically at the top of the food chain at Gombe. But the baboons are also pretty formidable. The male baboons, males are twice as big as the females, and I guess the male baboons weighed around 65 pounds, something like that. They were about the size of a German Shepherd. And they had these enormous fangs that were much bigger than a domestic dog. And so they were very formidable as well. And so there started to be these conflicts between the chimps and the baboons. And once that began, it didn't get better. It got worse. So Jane was not there during the time that it became the worst of the time, but they were always in contact with Jane by radio telephone. Once a week, they would call her up, and so they said, you know, we can't do this anymore. So that Jane agreed that they would stop banana provisioning, except maybe once a week or something, just sort of basic enough so that at least they could keep track of the chimps. They would come in and check to see if there were bananas there, and usually there weren't. So they changed the provisioning system. They reduced the banana provisioning by a lot. And so now the question was, what do the researchers do if the chimps are not coming into camp? And the researchers who specialized in chimps decided we'd like to follow them out of camp. Jane showed up in the summer of 1968. She spent the summer there, and Jane agreed that this was actually a good system. So they started then. They started following the chimps into the forest. And it was an amazing event because I think they got to know the chimps much, much, much better that way by being essentially going into the world of the chimpanzees.
Right. And, of course, one of the things that we begin to glean from your book is the kind of connection that at least some of these researchers would form with these chimpanzees. I mean, relationships that sometimes almost felt like friendships. And, of course, it raises the really intriguing question of whether or not that is something based on a misunderstanding or jumping to conclusions about just what's going on within the mind of a chimpanzee. What kinds of insights did you gain as you ended up kind of exploring this once again?
Yeah, well, I think that's right. They did develop relationship with the chimpanzees, and it's true that how do you know what the chimp is thinking? Because they don't have language, they can't tell you what they're thinking. But you know, many times you know what they're thinking in the way that you know what a person is thinking when that person is not telling you. You know, you can read facial expressions, you can read body language, and you know a lot about other humans that way. And likewise, you know a lot about chimpanzees. If you have a domestic dog, if you are a dog lover, as I am, the truth is you know a lot about. And dogs are not even chimpanzees. You know, they're not even similar to humans physically, but they have emotional connections, similarities, and you know what a dog is thinking. You know what a dog is feeling about you. They communicate it. So that's how, you know, I can say with great certainty that. These were friendships that developed. And the other part of it is, the other evidence of friendships is that the chimps had very, very, very clear preferences to people that they expressed in the most immediate way, which is the chimps would allow only certain people to follow them. Gombe is distinctive in that way. There are, you know, a half dozen or more major chimpanzee research sites in Africa at this point. And I've been to a number of them. None of them is as rugged as Gombe. And so that ruggedness has a special effect, which the special effect is it's very difficult for a human to follow a chimpanzee at Gombe. You know, chimps can climb a tree in 5 seconds. They can grab a vine and swing across a ravine, and you know, in ways that humans can't. They can, you know, walk up a steep hill. You know, they can run up a steep hill and that a human can't. So they can easily avoid being followed, and they would do that if they didn't like the person following them. So the individual chimps had particular preferences for individual humans. There was a chimpanzee named Hugh, a very physically magnificent male, looked like a weightlifter, I mean, tremendously built, and a very formidable animal who just did not like females, including chimpanzee females and human females. He did not treat them well. You know, he'd throw stones, that sort of thing. But he liked Ruth. And he would allow Ruth to follow him. And Ruth was the only one of the researchers. There were three researchers, Ruth Davis, the one who died, Carol Gale, and Geza Teleki. Only Ruth could follow Hugh. Likewise, there was another chimp named Leaky, and only Geza could follow Leaky, because Leaky just had a soft spot for Geza.
We should mention here that Ruth Davis came over to Tanzania with, I believe, no expectations of actually engaging in this kind of research. If I remember correctly, she was really brought over mostly to be a typist and perhaps to be a babysitter. and only kind of gradually found herself suddenly kind of drawn into this actual field work. Can you say a word about that and how common it was for somebody to kind of take this huge step of coming to Africa, but sometimes without clear expectations of just what the experience was going to bring them?
Right. Well, in Ruth's case, it was a special circumstance because she had been Geyser's girlfriend before Gombe. They had known each other in Washington, D.C. Before then. Geyser came to Gombe. His ambition was to be an anthropologist, and he thought this might be an introduction to some form of physical anthropology. So that was his motivation, and he came out and studied the chimps. But then he thought, well, maybe Ruth would work out well there. And Jane was always looking for volunteers to help with the operation. And among other things, there was a lot of typing to be done. And, you know, because all of the researchers were studying the chimps when they came into camp, taking notes by tape recorder. And so somebody had to transcribe those tapes every day. So there was, in fact, a lot of work for typists at Gombe, and that was why Ruth was first accepted as a volunteer. She would be a typist. Then she discovered that she was good at the research and discovered she liked the chimps, and so she became one of the main chimpanzee researchers.
Although only after surviving those first few days in which she was really terrified to be there. And I think that's one interesting thing, too, is that I probably typically the person who would set off for a place like Tanzania is somebody with kind of an adventurous spirit and inexorably drawn there. That was really not the case with Ruth Davis. She was, in probably many ways, an unlikely person to embark on an experience like this. And it was even more unlikely in terms of where it ultimately took her.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. She was a geology student, so she did have an interest in the outdoors and interest in the natural world. That was expressed in that way in college. She had been a geology major. So it's not completely out of character for her. And, of course, she was in love with Geyser, and so there was some sense in them being together. Geyser, I think, missed her, and she must have missed him, so that made sense.
Hmm. Of course, one question that surrounded then her unfortunate death, which was, it appeared to be some kind of a fall, is the fact that there were ways in which she was very unhappy there. And so at some point in time, the possibility was raised that perhaps her death was by suicide. Can you just speak briefly about her unhappiness and this suspicion that surrounded her death at some point?
Yeah, well, there were rumors. And there's no question that she was unhappy, particularly in the latter few months of 1969. Because Geyser had left, he had gone back to the States to report to his draft board, and there was seen to be a potential that he might be sent to Vietnam. It didn't happen because he was, nearly blind in one eye, so he failed the physical. But he was gone, and when he was gone, Ruth was extremely lonely and did not really get along with other people in camp. So that's part of the social tension that I explore in the book. And I think it's I understand that. I understand being in a crowd and not being happy. That does happen.
Dale Peterson. He is responsible for this very, very intriguing look at the important work of Jane Goodall and some of the tremendous challenges that are a part of doing this kind of work in the wilds of a place like Tanzania. and particularly when one has no experience in doing so. It's a very meticulously researched and written book. I want to thank Dale Peterson for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about his book, The Ghosts of Gombe, a true